Okay. Any preliminary issues, questions, problems? All right. Well, we left off yesterday on the verge of talking about vicarious liability, and again, just to reemphasize that we're not looking at a new way to establish negligence. What we're looking at is a way to take a claim of negligence and sort of transferring it or applying it to someone typically with deeper pockets. So we have a couple of different things going on here in terms of concepts or limitations, but we can just plunge into the case here, and I think the things will emerge as we go along. Ms. Sullivan, can you tell us about Hayes? Must have been about Res Ipsa Loquitur, don't you think? Yeah. Okay. And again, when use the term defendant to talk about McGrath, the lawyer, but what we're interested in this case is the law firm as a defendant, and the question of whether or not they can be held liable for what McGrath did. And again, this is just one part of the case. There's another part of the case, I assume, that has to do with the plaintiff's claim against the bar that served the alcohol prior to the shooting. But we're only concerned here with the appeal from a summary judgment granted to the law firm when the law firm said, as a matter of law, we can't be held liable for what McGrath did. Now, in arguing that, in fact, the law firm can be held liable for what McGrath did, the plaintiff relies on a previous Washington case. What's that? Or what's it about? Do you remember what it was about? Yes, that's the one. And what happens in Dickinson? How does the plaintiff try to draw the analogy between that case and this one? Well, moving from that case, they come up with this three-prong analysis, but let's figure out whether this case is enough like Dickinson that a similar result could be applied. What happened in Dickinson? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's the result in that case? Okay, so the employer is held liable for a motor vehicle accident caused after the employee over-consumed at a company banquet. And I still have this left over from the 11 o'clock section here. The summary of the law in this area is that an employer is vicariously liable for an employee's negligence that occurs in the course and scope of employment. So, going back to Dickinson, was the was the employee acting in the course and scope of employment when his vehicle struck the plaintiff in Dickinson? Right. Nice work if you can get it. But you're right. It's and that's the important distinction, that even though the motor vehicle accident did not occur while the employee was in the course and scope of employment, the court held in Dickinson that the employee was acting in the course and scope of employment when he overconsumed at the banquet. And because that overconsumption proximately caused the injury to the plaintiff out on the highway, the employer could be held vicariously liable for the injury. Okay, so that's what happened in Dickinson, and the question is, can we transfer that principle to this case and hold the law firm liable for what McGrath did out in the parking lot? Again, let's be clear, when McGrath is out in the parking lot, gets his gun and shoots the plaintiff, was that act in the course and scope of his employment? No, but it doesn't have to be. What does the plaintiff have to prove to make the law firm liable for McGrath's later shooting? Okay. So just as the employee in Dickinson overconsumed at the banquet, can't the plaintiff in this case succeed by showing that McGrath overconsumed while in the course and scope of his employment? Okay. Now, on that point, what evidence do we have? I mean, it seems a little bit odd. It's one thing to be I forget who the employer was in the Dickinson case, but he goes to a company banquet and he's consuming alcohol at a basically, you know, a social function. Here, the plaintiff would have to show that McGrath was drinking while practicing law, which seems just a little bit strange. But how strong is the case on that point? Okay, you're correct in saying that the court refuses to draw the connection here, because whereas in Dickinson they say as the employee is accepting the offer of more alcohol, the employee has in mind, I've got the car sitting out there, I'm going to have to drive home, maybe I should get a designated driver or stop drinking. Whereas the court in this case says, sitting at the bar, McGrath had no reason to think that he would later be called upon to use his firearm. And therefore, while the employee in Dickinson was negligent, McGrath was not negligent in saying, sure, I'll have another pitcher. Or refill my glass. Okay, but just so we're clear about whether it's in the course and scope of employment, does the law firm at least have an argument that while they didn't have an explicit prohibition of lawyers never practicing law and drinking at the same time, in this particular instance, McGrath was outside of their boundaries in terms of how much you should be drinking and still claiming that you're practicing law. How strong is the law firm's argument on that point? He was exercising his own judgment in going out there, and now it could very well be that the law firm would in some situations encourage their employees, for example, to take their clients. Let's suppose you invite your client to go golfing with you, and you're on the golf course at the 19th hole, you know, drinking to excess. That might be viewed as a way to get more clients, and that would be in the course and scope of employment. But practicing law would be a little bit different. Didn't allow him to build, they billed his hours. Worse. I mean, you're absolutely right. It just seems like an exercise in incredibly poor judgment on the law firm's part. Couldn't we forego these 2.7 hours of billing in exchange for saying, whoa, apparently McGrath no longer works there, understandably so. They figured it was cheaper than supplying everybody in the firm with bulletproof vests. But again, the law firm is dead in the water in terms of trying to distance themselves from McGrath. They've conceded that point by billing the hours. But you already got to the point of distinction that the court found relevant, not that he was not in the course and scope of employment, but that he wasn't negligent. Do you buy that? Why not? What's unpersuasive to you about the court's opinion? We don't really know the sequence here of exactly where it is he's getting intoxicated and where the gun is. And remember that when he leaves the bar and goes out to his car, he's like the guy leaving the banquet going off on the highway. He leaves the course and scope of his employment. But would it be your position that just the availability of the firearm, that it's sitting out there in the car, makes it at least arguably negligent? Again, the standard we're dealing with here is whether the court could say, as a matter of law, he was not negligent, as distinguished from saying a jury will need to decide whether the risk of his later poor decision-making with regard to a gun, whether that made his decision to keep drinking negligent. So you would not have signed this opinion with the majority. You would have said it's a question of fact for the jury, and only, but if the jury says that under those circumstances a reasonable person would have said, well, I'm trying to practice law here, and knowing that I have a firearm out there, and knowing that bars tend to generate, if I'm in my lawyer mode here, kind of aggressive and a little bit belligerent, it's probably a bad idea for me to lower, as alcohol does, lower my ability to kind of make good judgments. You know, sober the person three stools down in the bar, I would recognize is a bad idea. A couple of drinks later, suddenly this seems like a more promising opportunity here. Sober, I would recognize I shouldn't have anything to do with that gun. 0.015 blood alcohol content later, the gun looks to me like a smart way to resolve a dispute. So, if that connection is one that a jury could find, then we shouldn't sign this opinion. We should say motion for summary judgment should have been denied. Let the jury decide on the basis of the evidence what a reasonable person would have done. But then again, you could say as a matter of law, it's unforeseeable. Mr. Johnson?
test one, test two, test one, test two, 1, 2, 3, testing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 4.
Let me see if I can.
I don't know if that made it go away or not, but I think. Oh, you go ahead. That didn't make it go away. Okay. Well, I think the rule the court announces based on Dickinson, this three-prong test, is they're still following that test. The what they're doing in this case is defining what makes something negligent. Something, an action is negligent when a person has reason to think that there's a risk associated with their behavior. And what the court says, in this case, as a matter of law, reasonable minds could not find that when he's the waiter waitress comes up and says, do you want another gin and tonic, that at that moment, the court says, there was no reason to think that accepting that offer was a negligent thing. It turned out to affect his later behavior, but the court doesn't think that there was any reason for the person. And again, if you want to argue in the court's favor, suppose I'm at home and I have a firearm in the house and I'm deciding whether to open another bottle of wine with this dinner I'm having with some other people. Does it become negligent for me to open that bottle of wine knowing that I have access to a firearm? Now, I think you could say the situation for McGrath is different. He's in a bar. He's trying to practice law. There might be other facts and circumstances that would suggest in this environment it was a bad idea, but the court doesn't see the connection. Speaking of the connection... What's that? If you wouldn't mind, I would probably. I was thinking of doing it myself, but you're a generous soul here. Ms. Collier, were you trying to throw something in here? No. I want to make sure we're clear on how vicarious liability, again, is not a new way. It's not a new way to establish liability. Vicarious liability is a way to take something that is already found to be negligent and, in effect, transfer it to somebody else. Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but I think this will work. There are actually different ways to attach liability to an employer for what an employee does. And so I mentioned this in, where are we here? Yeah, the bottom of page 42, right-hand column, note number 3, spilling over to the top, employer hires a security guard. Security guard goes, approaches this patron at the rock concert and says, would you like to get a closer view of the stage? She accepts the invitation. She says, well, we got to climb under this, you know, get under the bleachers here, you know, take on a shortcut here. Then he assaults her. She sues the employer not on the basis of vicarious liability, not because the security guy was in the course and scope of his employment when he assaulted her, but because they were negligent in the way they hired or supervised these security people. They basically gave him $50 and a T-shirt and said, "You're our security," a little bit like the Rolling Stones hiring the Hell's Angels at the Altamont concert. Now, again, the difference between these two ways of establishing liability are, on the one hand, for vicarious liability, the employee has to be acting in the course and scope of employment. If it's not part of the course and scope of a security officer's job to sexually assault the concert goers, which it is not, then we can't use vicarious liability. But we may be able to show that even though the act was outside the course and scope of employment, the employer negligently hired or supervised the employees. So this one, you have to show course and scope of employment, but you don't have to show the employer's negligence. If I'm Safeway and I hire truck drivers to take groceries from the warehouse to the retail stores, if the employee in the course and scope of employment runs somebody over, it's irrelevant that Safeway has the most modern, wonderful hiring practices. They screen people. They have all these training programs and encourage safe driving. They're just the world's greatest employer. There's nothing in any way negligent about the way Safeway treats their employees. If the negligence of the employee occurs in the course and scope of employment, there's liability. By contrast, even if the act is clearly outside the course and scope of employment, if you can show the employer is negligent in hiring or supervising, then you can establish liability that way. The main thing is not to be sort of confused about these two, so you're mixing and matching and either trying to establish negligence on the part of the employer or thinking that the employer's lack of negligence is any defense in a vicarious liability situation, or thinking that you can be vicariously liable for things that lie outside the course and scope of employment. You can be liable, but not vicariously liable. So again, this is a principle of agency. Someone that I hire, that I make an agent, is doing my work and is, in that sort of context, they are me. They act on my authority and they make me liable by what they do. But again, that presupposes that they are acting for me as opposed to departing from that. So in the Carlson case, the security officer that goes off assaulting the concert goer, he's left the employment of Wackenhoot. He's not doing their work anymore. But since the theory is not based on vicarious liability, that isn't the end of the story. Okay? Yeah, Mr. LeBanc? It's not so much that it's so negligent as it is that it becomes intentional or criminal. So let's say that David DeWolf thinks he's not making enough money as a law professor, and he gets this email from somebody saying, "Dear Mr. DeWolf, your name was given to me as a person of discretion. I had several million dollars in a bank in Lagos, Nigeria, which has been impounded by the blah, 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 and if you will only forward me," and I'm thinking, gee, I want to get into this. You know, so I then start sending emails to people. I, Professor David K. DeWolf, I'm handling these important trust funds for people, but I decide I can get in on this scam, and I start using my computer, my name, to lure people into sending me money. And eventually, somebody complains, and I'm found out to be a fraud. And then people start suing Gonzaga University because they say, look, this was sent out on a Gonzaga University computer, signed David K. DeWolf, professor of law at Gonzaga University. We want the university to pay for what this guy did. Now, the question would be, when I did that, was I in the course and scope of employment? And sometimes that's a difficult question. In the fact pattern I've just given you, I don't think it is a difficult question because I'm not trying to do my employer's work, however poor my judgment is. So when the Safeway truck driver climbs into his truck at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, I really should have left this bar 3 hours ago. I've got to be in, you know, Tukwila before 7 a.m. So, put the pedal to the metal. Here we go. It may be he's speeding, he's drunk, he's doing all these other things. He's very, 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 very negligent, but he's still trying to do his job. If I'm using my computer to try to scam people and defraud them, even though it's, it looks like it's coming from the university, it's not in the course and scope of employment. There were some, one of the big ticket items in this area is the whole, sexual exploitation or sexual abuse. And the early cases suggested that if the employee used their connection in the same way that I could say, David K. DeWolf, professor of law, I have these trust funds, they're lured into trusting me because of my affiliation, because they put on the cloak of the employer. There were some early cases that suggested you could do that even in cases of sexual abuse. So there was a case in Orange County where a sheriff in Orange County answered a domestic violence call, and he encouraged the woman who had made the call or was involved somehow to go with him in his squad car, which she did. And while she's in the squad car, the sheriff then turns on her and threatens her or whatever and sexually assaults her. She sued the Orange County, claiming, gee, it was because of the, flashing lights and the badge and the uniform. That's why I got into a car with this guy. And therefore, he was within the course and scope of employment, not because he was doing what you wanted him to do any more than the Safeway truck driver would be doing what Safeway wanted him to do when he's drunk and speeding and so forth. But from my perspective, it looked like this was somebody I could trust, and you're the one that gave him all the stuff that made me trust him. Same argument with, clergy or school teachers or psychiatrists or what have you, who use their position to say, well, normally we don't do this, but you can trust me, this will be good for you, et cetera, et cetera. As I say, the early cases on that point were sort of equivocal, but the modern view of that is no way, no how. That sexual abuse is never in the course and scope of employment. But with respect to other kinds of criminal conduct, whether it's in the course and scope of employment, sometimes it's a little bit narrow. But again, the typical dividing line is employees either trying to do the employer's job, however misguided they may be, versus employee knows, employer would be horrified, and an employee is simply using the cover of the employer to gain access to confidential, to trust relationships which they can then exploit. Again, this is obviously a big ticket item. The Archdiocese of Boston just, put up $85 million to settle all the claims against them. Again, not because they're vicariously liable, but because of claims of negligent hiring and supervision. That's where the problem lay. But the original, the early, that Orange County case was like 20 or 25 years ago when this was not yet quite the big, ballooning problem that it's turned out to be. But in those early cases, there was certainly the plaintiffs were trying to establish a rule of law that says vicarious liability can apply not only when the employee is trying to do their job, however misguided they are, but it also applies where the employee uses the cloak of authority given to the employee by the employer. So that would apply to the priest or to the psychiatrist or to the school teacher who says, in effect, you're my special person here, and because you're so special to me, I want to do these things and so forth and so on. And it's lots of victims succumb to this explanation. Yes. If you want to get the institution, you've got to show negligent hiring supervision. You may be familiar with the case of Mary Kay Letourneau, the school teacher in Tacoma or wherever it was, seduces her sixth grade pupil. I think he's 12 years old at the time this affair began. She has a child. She goes to prison. She gets out of prison. She goes back to him. He goes back to her. They have another child. She's now in prison for a longer time. He sued the school district and the Tacoma Police Department because it had not gone unnoticed. Lots of the other kids in the school or other teachers had observed the relationship between this teacher and the student and thought it was a little bit weird. They didn't know all of the details, obviously, but from what they could observe, it did seem weird. So he was actually, I think, 18 or 19 when the lawsuit was filed and sued the school district and the police department and tried to establish, it was on Court TV, I don't know if you saw any of it, but they did have it on the actual trial on Court TV. Then the evidence, again, didn't look good for the school district or for the police department either because, of course, in the light of 20/20 hindsight, here are all these things which were evidence of an unhealthy relationship and nobody did anything about it in a timely way. Well, in the end, the jury, for various reasons, rejected the plaintiff's argument and found for both the city of Tacoma Police Department and for the school district, and there was a lot of speculation about whether this was gender related, that if the gender roles had been reversed, if it had been a sixth grade girl and a male teacher, whether or not the jury would have felt the same way, but be that as it may, the plaintiff was unable to meet their burden to show that the school district was negligent in failing to recognize this and do something about it. Mr. Brown. Okay. Well, I think the theory is that the employee could not have understood this to be in any way, shape, or form part of their job. And to that extent, again, if you and I are the taxpayers of the city of Spokane, let's say, and we hire police officers, if those police officers do negligent things in the course and scope of their employment. If, for example, they beat up Rodney King, even though we decide they were actually violating Rodney King's civil rights when they beat him up, they're bad police officers and they go to jail for that. Still, they were trying in their misguided way to do their job at the time. It wasn't simply hauling off and pulling somebody out of their car and beating them up. By contrast, so the theory goes, where the police officer, sexually assaulting this woman in the police car, sheriff's car, doesn't in any way further the interest of the taxpayers who pay that police officer, that sheriff's salary. Well, it. Okay, let me. I think I hear your question now, and let me see if I can provide you with a satisfactory answer. Let's change the scenario a little bit to talk about a church group or a scouting group or what have you. A community organization that has, a limited budget. Let's say you have a church with a $300,000 annual budget, and they hire people, Sunday school teachers, choir directors, et cetera, et cetera. In the process of doing their work, they will encounter children, and for that matter, other vulnerable people, where they could use their position for sexual advantage. Now, if something bad happens in the course of that, the fifth grade Sunday school teacher has a special outing with, a couple of the kids, and in this special outing, the kids get molested. First time, we don't have a prior history of that, but that doesn't remove the idea of negligent hiring or supervision. If I'm the plaintiff's lawyer in that case, what I would ask the jury to consider is almost a sort of learned hand calculus. That is, what's the magnitude of the harm, first of all? Huge magnitude of harm. This is really devastating, a very devastating experience for the victim. What's the probability of it occurring? I mean, sadly, instead of this being the last place you would ever think to find a predator, it turns out that predators seek positions of trust where they can, groom their victims and exploit them, just as a thief would look toward, working in a bank so that the thief can embezzle. So far from being, oh, gee, I never would have thought this person wanted to work in a bank. I never occurred to me that they try to steal the money. Well, hello. In a similar way, when someone says, oh, I just love working with kids, well, we would hope that that's all genuine and so forth and so on. But a reasonable person, would look at what's the burden over here, relatively modest burden in terms of a little bit of background check, a little bit of, sort of supervising, maybe kind of checking up on this person, keeping an eye on the relationship with these children to find out if we've got a problem. That burden is relatively modest compared to the probability of harm and the magnitude of harm. So that I would argue that, in fact, from the defendant's standpoint, if you run a school or you run a youth kind of outward bound, I don't care what it is, or you run a nursing home or you run some other institution that has vulnerable people that you serve and your employees have access to confidential situations where they can exploit the people you supposedly serve, you have a pretty tough row to hoe. You have to be pretty vigilant to try to avoid this. And the same thing would be true But as far as the police officers are concerned, whether they sexually assault their victims or, you know, shoot them or, you know, whatever they do to them that's illegal, that they know is a violation of the law, it all falls under the same heading. That is, as the employer, have I exercised reasonable procedures to identify the kinds of people that are suitable for the trust that's placed in them, or have I negligently put a gun in the hand of, you know, given a badge and a uniform and a gun to someone who's a ticking time bomb? And so just on that standard, again, it's not a rule that every dog gets one bite. Oh, the first one's free. Only after the first one is there any liability. Quite the contrary, you can establish negligent hiring or supervision on the first go-round, as in Carlson versus Wackenhut. The question was, did you do a reasonable job screening your employees before you handed them the badges, the cloak of authority, which allowed them then to get people to trust them, which led to the harm? So, you know, again, I think if anything, institutions would have the right to be grumpy about the fact that as it stands, you're kind of a sitting duck for these things, and what you know, what nonprofit organization is in a position to do all the fancy things you want done to screen these employees? Yeah. It might, but we don't get any evidence. That wasn't the theory under which this case was presented. But there may be evidence back there that McGrath was, for other reasons, a person known to be volatile. And therefore, the employer should have said, if you want to go drink, go drink, but don't do it while you're, you know, if I were running a law firm, I wouldn't be shocked that my employees are going out socializing with clients or even with other lawyers, but the notion that the perception is our lawyers, you know, do it with a martini glass in their hand, not a very good bumper sticker, is it, you know? I think the employer would be wise to stay away from that. So again, there might be facts here, but we're not presented with the kind of record that would make it sound as though the employer had noticed that he was at risk of firing on somebody in the parking lot. Yeah. Yes. Sure. And that's actually one of the places that I would have liked the court to address this question, which somebody asked in the 11 o'clock section. What would have happened if McGrath had hit somebody on the highway? Presumably, you would go back and say his behavior drinking to excess was negligent. Well, if his behavior was negligent, the fact that the harm turned out to be a different kind of harm, it was negligent because of his risk of driving, it turns out that his impairment affected his decision to use a gun rather than his control of steering wheel, but negligence is negligence, one might think. So why isn't it, I would have liked the court to address, why isn't it that being negligent with respect to driving would make it negligent also, oh, and by the way, he's got a gun out in the car. Yeah. Well, right, Right. And there again, I think what the court is struggling with is the notion that we could fairly say of McGrath that as the waitress comes by offering to bring him another gin and tonic, that he should have, at that point, a reasonable person would have said, no, drinking brings out the worst in me. And that might be true. And it might be true both with respect to driving and getting into a fight and, you know, I'll say things I'll regret, I'll spill my confidences. You know, for all kinds of reasons, I really should say no and have mineral water and, you know, get home. But I think what the court has trouble essentially making that kind of strong statement. And then it's hard to identify why it is that he should have particularly had in mind the risk of a handgun. But for my own money, for what it's worth, I would be inclined to at least let the jury have at it. I think what I would say is I'll deny the motion for summary judgment and will essentially allow a better record to be established with respect to what all went on in the bar and whether or not that was something which was, under the circumstances, a reasonable thing to do, or whether, in fact, he was negligent. Yeah. Even his law firm stops billing at 11 p.m. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. So now what? But why the law firm should not? Well, see, again, to the extent that you're making the analogy to Dickinson, you say the behavior leading up to 11 o'clock is like the consumption at the banquet. That's what led to the behavior later on. If he hadn't been drinking up to 11, and it appears that he's sort of, you know, refilling his tank. He's, you know, watching his blood alcohol level drop, and then he, you know, spikes it back up again so that he can maintain this level. And so he starts prior to 11 and then just maintains that from 11 till 2 when he gets into trouble. So to that extent, the pre 11 o'clock behavior sets up what happens later on. And if that is in the course and scope of employment while he's still on the clock, but again, the court rejects the idea that it was negligent. So, again, well, the basic principle here that employers are liable for the employee's negligent acts in the course and scope of employment, pay attention to both of these two ideas. I'm not sure that they're meant to be expressing these two distinct things, but it's sort of useful to anchor them to that. Is he on the job, on the clock, so to speak? That's one consideration. The other question is it in the scope of employment? Are we talking about criminal intentional conduct that clearly falls outside what the employee was hired to do, or is it the kind of conduct that wasn't a good idea? The employer would disapprove, but remember, that's not inconsistent. The guy who fails to ring the gong is disobeying his employer's instructions, but the disobedient servant still makes the employer vicariously liable. There's one other thing we need to talk about. I'll try to start with this tomorrow, and that is the distinction between an employee and an independent contractor. So that there are certain people that we hire, we pay them by the hour, but they're not our employees. So, for example, the dentist may charge me for putting, you know, a crown on my teeth, but the dentist is not my employee. I don't tell him how to do the work. He has his own professional standards. Even the electrician that I hire to come and replace a light fixture is an independent contractor because the choice of methods and so forth is of his choosing, not of mine. But the person that I hire to mow my lawn is my employee because I have the right to control how they do their work. And so we'll pick that up, as I say, tomorrow.